Hey, I'm Debbie Harris, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I'd like to thank Pat for asking me to share tonight. It's always a privilege and a real responsibility to me to be asked to participate and share my story in any Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, because I know that that something I may say could affect somebody, and it better be Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's all I have to share with you, because Alcoholics Anonymous has provided me a life, and everything in my life is a direct result of the things you've taught me to do here. The timing of my sharing tonight is coincidental, so to speak. Pat called me like last June to book this, and little did we know that this would be the last Wednesday night meeting I would be attending for a while because of what you've taught me to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, to get up and suit up and show up. I have been asked to go to New York for a while on a work project, which is very much of an honor for me. From a former boss of mine has asked me to go there, and I'll be leaving Saturday with one trip home a month. And I have a lot of, you know, AA friends in New York, but you've taught me to do these things every day. You've taught me how to be one among many, and you've taught me how to be a good worker among workers and how to give a full day's work for a full day's pay. And as a result of that, this opportunity has come to me. And so I thank you for all the things that you've given me and all the things that you've taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I wasn't interested in showing up before. And so I have this opportunity to publicly say to you, thank you very much. There's three things that I always like to share when I talk, because I think they're three of the most important things, because I found with these three things, everything else falls into place. First is my sobriety date. I don't tell you to impress you, because there's many people here sober much longer than I, but I've been sober since February the 8th, 1976. So if you're counting, that means I've been sober this time a little over 13 years. But this is not my first sobriety date. And the reason it's not my first sobriety date is because when I was first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't interested in doing the things that you needed to do to stay sober on a daily basis. And when I came back this time, almost 14 years ago now, I was willing for the first time to go to any lengths. And therefore, subsequently, I have stayed sober a day at a time. And so if you're new here tonight and want anything that we have, I encourage you to get a sobriety date. First, another of the three things that I find very important is a home group. I know many of you have the Pacific Group as your home group. My home group is the Bellflower Big Book Group on Monday nights. And I know I was ready for that this time. But I love this group very much, and many, many of the people in it are very special to me. But I have a home group, and in every city I've lived in, I've had a home group. And the reason is because I was about 7-8 years sober or whatever when I was in my home group in Atlanta at that time. And it was one of those nights when I drove to the meeting and didn't really feel like going, but I'm trained to go, and you go no matter what, and I'm driving, and I arrive, and after I've been there a while, a gal comes in and says, you're still here. Because you see, her story was that she had just come back, and she'd been there a year before, and she'd been out drunk. And her simple statement to me said, I said, yeah, we are still here, because I was reminded that we are not some secret organization that packs up at midnight and moves and doesn't tell you. If I tell you in my home group meeting, keep coming back, by golly, I better be there so that you don't think I'm lying to you. Because if somebody starts lying to you, who are you going to believe? And this is where I've learned to trust people in that they do mean what they say, and more importantly, they do what they say. And so I encourage you to get a home group. And the third thing is a sponsor. I feel very fortunate that I've only had three sponsors. I have only lived in three different states in sobriety. I get a little choked up because my sponsor is here and means a very great deal to me, and I will miss her very much. I didn't get my first real live official sponsor, I call it like that, till I was 3 years sober. And the reason I put it that way is because I was the kind in the beginning, I'd call you up and ask you to be my sponsor, and you'd say yes, and then that would just be the last phone call I made to you, you know. Or I would ask you at a meeting and you'd say yes, and I'd change meetings. You know, I don't know why I went through this exercise, but I did. But when I was three, I finally found my first real live official sponsor, and from that moment to this, I have not been without an active sponsor in my life. And it's my job to be active with my sponsor. It is my job, because this is my sobriety, for me to participate in and to do the reaching out in. It is not for friends or other people to know that they're supposed to call me and find out how I am. It's my job because it's my sobriety. And so if you don't have any of those three things, I sure encourage you to get them as soon as you can, because the rest all falls into place. And you will enjoy a type of life that you never even knew existed. I had my first several things when I was 12 years old. I was an only child at that time, and it was 1970, and a lot of things would happen that year that would set many directions in my life. And the first was that my parents, I was an only child, we lived in a little town in South Dakota at that time, and the first was that my parents would separate and would later divorce. But I didn't think anything really that was that terrible, because to me, being selfish and self-centered was very natural. And so to me it was just, well, now I'll get more presents and I'll get less discipline and I'll be able to have more freedoms and run my own life a little bit better. I didn't quite think of it in those specific words, but that was the idea. It was more for me, because now I'd have two. And so despite the fact that anybody else's life was being affected, that's how I looked at that beginning. And in April of that year, the second Friday in April of 1970, I had my first drunk. And I knew it was going to be my first drunk, because I had been invited to join a group of girls to a party that night, upcoming Friday, and I couldn't wait. I was so excited, and it was like my debut. You know, I was really going to have my coming out party or something, and little did I know that's about what it would end up being. I knew I was going to drink, and somewhere along the line, I just knew I would get drunk. I went with the singleness of purpose that night to get drunk. And now, I had never seen anybody drunk prior to that evening. My parents were not alcoholic drinkers. I mean, it couldn't have been more middle American apple pie kind of stuff. I mean, my mother stayed home and baked bread and made the beds. My dad went to work and came home and had supper on the table at 6. When I saw them drink, that was the only drinking I saw. They would take that old dusty whiskey bottle off the cupboard, uncap it. God knows how long it had been in there. They'd pour their guests a drink, they'd put ice and mix and foo-foo and any other kind of stuff. They'd recap it and shelve it. And then they would have their drinks and they would be nice to each other, and that was what they did. And I never saw any other drinking like that. And however, when I began to drink, I never drank like that. Because the way I would drink is I would take that fresh whiskey bottle, uncap it, and toss the cap, because I'm never going to need it again, you know? Don't need any extra baggage. And so that was And I never thought anything unusual about that. I arrived that night at 6 o'clock, and the pattern would be set, which to me would be normal. Everybody drinks like this. And I drank abusively from the gate. It didn't make any difference if it was beer or liquor or mixed or straight or out of a bottle or in a glass. It didn't make any difference because there was a lot of combinations there that night. And I just loved it all. And the change began to happen to me right away. It was so gradual, it felt like I'd been living that way all my life. It did not seem unusual at all. I did not think I'll only have one or two. Those kinds of numbers never entered my mind, one or two drinks. They never entered my mind during my drinking. That night I had my first blackout. I passed out for the first time, and I had my first case of dry heaves. And I came to at 9 o'clock that evening, 3 short hours after I'd had that first drink, and they drugged me away from the party for some reason, and I wanted to go back because I'd had a good time. Who knows what I did, but that didn't matter. I had a good time. And they wouldn't take me back, but I couldn't wait until I could drink again. And Saturday morning, those were my awakening thoughts. How can I get something for tonight? And that seemed as natural to me as breathing. That did not seem unusual, and yet I had only, not even 24 hours before, been drunk for the very first time. And it was just as natural as it could be. A few girlfriends and I got a couple cases of beer that night for Saturday night, and I immediately got caught. And my thoughts were not, well, you know, I am only 12 years old. Maybe I should wait till I'm of legal age. You know, maybe I should. Well, I'm here to tell you I've never had a drink of legal age. Every time I'd get there, they raised it. So I've never had a drink to this date of legal age. And, of course, hope I never do. But that was not my attitude that evening when I was caught. My thoughts were I'm just going to have to find a better hiding place. I'm going to have to be a little bit more deceptive. And my drinking did not change from that time until, you know, the last time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. The frequency was the only thing that changed. Towards the end, about the last year and a half or so, my kind of day that I always shot for anyway was a bottle of whiskey and a hit or two of acid, because that was my kind of day. And with that combination, I'll tell you what, you'll see some truth. With that, you'll see it like no one else does, I'll assure you. So that was my idea of a good day. 5 years and 3 weeks after that first drunk, I found myself committed to a hospital for alcoholism and drug addiction at the age of 17. And this was in Grand Forks, North Dakota. And during that 7 week stay there, I learned a lot of things. But there's one incident mainly that I want to tell you about, and it's only a reminder for me, because sometimes I want to maybe think I came in differently. You know how sometimes we want to think we were different than when we really were. And the Saturday morning, we were all gathered up, 10 of us, I guess. And we were put into a group therapy session and all given a piece of paper and a pencil, and we were to write on one side, I am in 10 things, and on the other side, I like in 10 things. And I thought that was kind of unfair to give me a test like that. You know, it was my first day. I haven't even been off the streets 24 hours. I don't know what they want to hear and what I'm supposed to put down there. So I just thought, well, I'll be as honest as I can. I mean, what have I got to lose? And so I was, and we all wrote them on a board, and mine was last. And I had on there some of the very similar things that, you know, you would have put down. I like to drink and party, get high, all that kind of stuff like that. But there were two things a little unusual, and that I told them that I was an avid Hitler fan and that I practiced voodoo. And I just want to explain those because I'd like to leave alive here tonight. At that time, the issue on Hitler was that my attitude was I was of German descent, and I had done a lot of studying on Hitler and all that kind of thing. And, you know, he didn't have it too good growing up himself. And, you know, he was kind of abused a little bit. And, you know, in some circles, hey, you could say he came from a dysfunctional family. I mean, you know, a lot of stuff gets blamed on that. Why not World War II, you know? I don't believe that way today. We're not here to discuss history or politics, but that was how I felt at that time, you know? And the other issue on the voodoo, my attitude was, hey, if you had a stepmother like I did, you would practice voodoo too. But they didn't quite agree with me on those points and asked me a very simple question, which one of the two questions in my past number of years that just made the turn for me. And he said simply, what kind of a world do you live in? Is it real or is it fantasy? And for the first time, to me, somebody pointed out that there was a difference between the two. Because you see, to me, okay, well, I mean, I said fantasy. I mean, there was no question about it. It just came out. Because to me, okay, if there's a difference, let's say that this is reality. Well, pal, if this is reality, this is where I don't drink. And this is where I have all this stuff inside, these hot rocks of mine that seem to cool down when I have a drink. This is where all the hate and the confusion and the degradation is. And this is where my stepmother lives. And you know, we all know that story about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and the potion that changes them from one personality to the other. And this is where I felt like that Mr. Hyde. And if this is reality, then you can have it. Because you are absolutely right. I don't know how to live here, and I don't want to know how to live here. Because I have found that with a bottle of whiskey and a hit or two of acid, I can go up right out here into what you call fantasy, but it's as close to reality as I'm interested in getting. Because out here is where I'm okay with this. And I guess you're going to talk to me about trying to live here without alcohol and drugs. And frankly, I don't know if I don't know how interested I am. And I don't know if I want to not drink the rest of my life. My God, I'm 17 years old. That's a long road. And I don't know, but I have nowhere else to go at the moment. And I know if I leave, you'll find me and bring me back. So I'll just stick around. And that was my first day before I was going to find out a different way to live. I would be taken to outside meetings on Friday nights. And the easiest way for me to identify is to tell you how I found all the differences and yet in the same breath all the similarities. Because I would hear the people stand up and I would sit in the back row, farthest corner by the window. I don't want to sit too front. I don't want to hear that much. I don't want to catch anything. I don't want to be an alcoholic. I don't want to know very much. So I'm just going to stay in the back. But the problem was, is I heard an awful lot. And every time I would hear something up here, I would find the rationalization, but in here, I found in my own little way the identities. And they would talk about things like wrecking cars. And my attitude was, hey, I never have totaled a car in my life. Now, I had kind of a little drunk car, you know, how they were square at one time and now they're rounded out, you know, and I had forgotten what kind of condition my car had come in when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a little Pinto, and I just had never gotten around to getting that gas cap for it. You know what I mean? Somebody had stolen it, so I had an old mitten stuck in there, and it was just littered with trash on the inside and just reeked of everything you can about imagine. And shortly before I got sober, or was taken to this hospital, a good friend of mine had shot the window out of my car, you know? And that's how I arrived, but I didn't have a problem. You know, I wasn't having any trouble, and yet I was pretty much looked about like my car. And so when they talked about that, I rationalized that I've never had totaled a car. And they would talk about jails and institutions, and you know, this is the first thing I had ever been in, and it's going to be the last thing, I can tell you that. And when you talk about jails, I mean, most of you know my husband Johnny. God, he'd been in and out of his first prison before I was ever born. You know, I mean, so there were some serious people in here. And my attitude was, you know, I've only been in a jail 3 times, and every time it was a misunderstanding. You know, they talked about losing their jobs. And I had kind of forgotten that, yeah, I guess you could say I'd been fired from a couple jobs. I'd quit a few, but I had a bad habit of quitting in a blackout. And then, you know, I didn't know I'd quit, so I'd go in, you know. And that's kind of hard to explain sometimes, especially when you're not a very good liar to begin with, you know. And that was the kind of things that I would hear, but in my own little way I would identify, but just rationalize them away. And I wasn't serious about Alcoholics Anonymous or staying sober on an all-time basis or any of that stuff. And because, like the book said, in my opinion, there was still time yet. There was still time yet. Any penalties I was paying was nominal, just nothing, because it just didn't seem to be any big deal to me. I was sent to a halfway house, and I went to one meeting a month. And the only reason I even went that often was to get a piece of paper signed. I wasn't interested in staying sober. And I came to California, and I was in San Jose to visit my mother, and while there I drank again. I went back to Minnesota. 5 weeks later, I felt I'd learned my lesson. I went from one a month to one a week. And on a Friday, I got a letter in the mail that had a lump in it, which was one joint. And I decided, like any still uncommitted alcoholic, to keep it just in case. You know, I never know when I'm going to need it. And I just didn't know it'd be the next day, you know. I only had one thought on my mind, and that was to smoke that one joint. But that was on the 7th of February. I take my sobriety date on the 8th as my first sober day. But on that day, I had no idea that that would be the last day to this day that I would take anything. And I didn't know that that would be my day of surrender. I think of everybody's story, that's my very favorite day. I can listen to that day over and over again, because if I could have picked my day, I maybe would have picked something more memorable or catchy or something. But it wasn't to be. And I had no idea when I woke up that morning that that would be my day. And I smoked that one joint, and what happened to me is that the conflict, which is what I had fought for so long to dull and get rid of, was so great it was explosive, and I could no longer do anything about it. And I just knew the only answer laid for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd had enough. It did just enough what it had to do. I didn't know that the first period of time I didn't drink for my dad, and that the second period of time I didn't drink for the halfway house. I didn't realize that. You know, everything seemed to come into focus. This time I just wanted to stay sober, not with an attitude of arrogance or I'll show them. It was just, I'm just done. I'm just done. And I've had that feeling a few more times in sobriety, not just with an issue of whether to drink or not, but with other things that you just give up because you're done. And so I got very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in Minneapolis at that time, and I went to the old timers to learn how to stay sober and what do they do, and I followed them around. And to me at that time, at 18 years old, an old timer was anybody who'd been sober longer than I'd been alive. And there were a lot of them, and still at 32, there's still a whole lot of those people around. But I've always had old-timers in my life, and I've kept myself surrounded with them. And I went to them, and I followed them, and I did what they did, and they just kept me under their wing, and I was active. And I was almost 4 years sober when I moved to Atlanta, and I'd be there almost 7 years. And in Atlanta, it was different. And I went down there and I knew that, you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans, because they could care less how we did it wherever I came from. And so I wanted to, so I thought, well, I'll just kind of take it easy and I'll see how they do things here, but I'll go to 3-4 meetings a week, pick up new people, you know, things I've been taught to do here. But you see, for the next 2 years, that was my problem. That's all I did. That's all I did was go to 3, maybe 4 meetings that week. Every 6 months or once a year, pick up somebody new that I would happen to run into. And I've learned as a result of that there's a whole lot more to Alcoholics Anonymous than just showing up. Some days that's the best thing I got going for me, but there's a thing called the steps here. And I had taken them before, but somehow or another, the principles weren't being applied in my life. I seem to kind of have a dropping off point after 5, 6 through 11 didn't seem to come into sharp focus. And there's a whole lot more to this deal than just showing up a couple times a week. I mean, I knew when I went to 4 meetings a week, you know, boy, I'd really hit it hard that week. And now, who knows? I mean, it doesn't make a difference. I'm not keeping a scorecard on how many meetings I go to. It's just whatever the calendar is that week. And so I little by little became just gradually kind of insane. And I'm running my own life thinking I know what I'm doing and I don't. I have a sponsor, but I'm not being sponsored, which is a big difference. When they don't know much about you, it's hard to give you direction when you're not talking to them on a regular basis. I found myself at 6 years sober, and about 3 weeks after I turned 6 on a Friday night, I met a little fella. And what I'm about to share with you, I've seen happen to people, whether it be men or women or brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, parents, you name it, I've seen this happen no matter what. And I just went into a tailspin. I replaced, if you could have taken that human being and put a bottle of whiskey and a hit or two of acid in front of me, and you'd have seen the same exact personality, that obsession, that possession, and everything that went along with it. It just happened to be on a person. And it's a tough way to live. I tried to live that way for about 6 months. First with 3 months, with this merry-go-round, and it was during this time that I thought about temporary suicide. I thought about, getting drunk at him as if that's really going to do anything. I thought about all kinds of stuff. I would walk into a meeting with a real attitude of like, by God, you better say something magical tonight or we're all in trouble. You know, I mean, it would just... I went with an attitude of take, 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 and yet the only way I get relief is when I learn how to give, and that's what you've taught me here, but I wasn't doing anything like that. And you can just add your own list to the sickness, and that's certainly what happened. And I finally, after 3 months of a relationship that he didn't know he'd been involved in with me, something happened, and I had, you know, the guy got married to somebody else, you know. But I was a good sport. I let him go, you know. And I just seemed to kind of turn the corner, and by golly, there was another one just like it. And so I went through the same thing, except not as extreme, but 3 months later I married him off to somebody else too. I mean, it was like I was setting him up for the altar, you know. And at that point, I was so full of pain, and I thought many times I had been done, that I had let go, that I had been all these things, and I guess I hadn't, because I was still feeling it. But finally, I think it was about in October that I just had enough. I just couldn't do it anymore, and I surrendered one more time. And what happened to me is that first line in step 6 in the 12 and 12 came into play, and it says, this is the step that separates the men from the boys. And I knew now exactly what that meant. For me, it was very simple. You're either in or you're out. And there was no in-between. You either get in this deal 100% or you will be gone very soon. And that life was not appealing. Still is not appealing. This is the easiest thing I've ever had to do. And I went to a convention shortly after that, and on Friday night I heard people, places, and things don't make me happy. And I'm thinking, I've heard this a million times, and yet for some reason I'm hearing it as if for the very first time tonight. And I changed the words a little bit to be more appropriate to be men, money, and mansions don't make me happy. Not that any or all of those things are right, wrong, or indifferent, but what I wanted to do with them was I wanted to abuse them and take advantage of them, because my attitude was, hey, I just wanted to be humbly mega wealthy. That's all, you know. And let's get all this financial stuff taken care of, and then I'll just be so spiritual, you know, I can help everybody. And I can devote all my time to that. And, of course, you know, you've told me in your own examples and from the big book and everything, it doesn't work that way. The spiritual must always precede the material. Because I know when it does in that order for me, the material is not as important at all. And so that was what I heard Friday night. Saturday night I heard, if you've got family business to take care of, you better take care of it before they're dead and you say you wish you would have. And I was not prepared for that, because the skeleton of my stepmother in my own closet was yet to be made amends to. And it was the first time in my sobriety that I knew now is the time and I can make amends, because it's the first time I've ever had that feeling of not needing to have amends made to her or to me by her, and I had not felt that. And so I went back and I really took those steps over again from the beginning, and I felt so good, and I did each one of them as they're written and suggested and taught and with my sponsor, and I made my amends, and God, I felt so good, and I was like my Christmas present to me. And so I, throughout my seventh year, I lived on that good feeling, and I started trying to do that through my eighth year, and halfway through I'm starting to feel some familiar feelings called restless, irritable, and discontentment. And I don't have that spark of enthusiasm and sobriety like I like having, and I don't know what's happening. And I was in a meeting one night again, and this was the second thing that gave me a completely different direction. Because the guy said, and it wasn't anything like a big statement he said, it just happened to be drifting in a conversation as I re-listened to the tape. He said that he realized, and when he felt like that, that he'd been trying to live today on last year's program. And I don't know what else he said that night, but that gave me the key to my freedom. Because that's exactly what I did a year and a half ago was exactly that, what I had done a year and a half ago. I had not really been doing much of anything here today in my sobriety, making that participation. And I realize there aren't any badges or ribbons or medals for me to polish up and wear and adorn on my lapel or anything. You say, well, now this was when I did my fourth step, and there's nothing to say, well, this was 10, 11, and 12, and this was the last baby. You know, there isn't anything like that to wear. And yet there is in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just not in that kind of a sense. Because the badges and medals I've seen worn here in Alcoholics Anonymous have been in the eye. And the contentment I've seen in the people, and mostly the older members, that's who I went to. That's the kind of badges and medals they wore. That was my attraction. I try to apply that today and hope that every now and then somebody can look at me and see that I have peace on the inside too, because I live in a world mostly filled with comfort. And I'm talking inside comfort. If I don't have it on the outside, you know, or inside, I'll never have it on the outside. And so that's the kind of life I try to live today. Everything in my life has been as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. My husband and I were married 3 years ago. This was my first marriage. Well, I mean, I don't say that like I'm going to get married a whole bunch of times, but it was my first marriage, and I'm so pleased. We have a great life together. We're both very active AA members, and there will certainly be an emptiness in my heart when I go in New York. But it also is nice to know that you have a very secure and loving home life. And we not only practice the steps in our life, but the traditions are very, very important. I noticed that there were a lot of ahs when the long form was mentioned, and yet that was what we were first presented with in 1946, was the long form of the traditions. And I hope that someday you'll get to know them, and I hope that they will be as important in your life as they are in mine today. Because there is that, they have taught me how to live with you. The steps teach me how to live with me in my past life and my future, but the traditions have taught me how to live with you. For allowing me the extreme privilege to share with you tonight and be in another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and to close my day with you, I thank you.